9. Driving to pick up his truck that afternoon, Dale took the Canton Road shortcut to Oak Hill Road, a few miles away from Duane's farm. The dead zone, as he thought of it, his cell phone came alive again. The asphalt road was empty. The day was still warm. Dale drove with one hand on the wheel and punched in Sandy Whitaker's real estate number.
Heartland Realty?
It was Sandy answering. Dale identified himself, and there was the expected salvo of niceties. They both agreed that it was a beautiful fall day and very welcome after the cold and snow.
"Is everything all right, Mr. Stewart? Dale?"
said Sandy. Dale hesitated. He was tempted to ask about the upstairs life, but what could he say? "Say, Sandy, any reports of phantom lights on the McBride farmhouse?" Instead, he said, "Yeah, I was just wondering if you knew anything about a dog hanging around the farm I'm renting."
"A dog? What kind of dog?"
"A little one," said Dale. "A black one." There was a pause on the other end of the line. Dale drove by clean white farms and large barns. The road stayed empty.
"Never mind," said Dale. "Silly question."
"No, no," said Sandy Whitaker. "Have you seen a dog on the property?"
"In the house, actually."
"In the house?"
said Sandy. "I left the inside door open this afternoon. I guess the screen was open just enough to let a dog in. A little thing. It ran off, and I just wondered who it might belong to. Duane's aunt didn't own a dog, did she?"
"Mrs. Brubaker?"
said Sandy.
"No. No, I'm sure she didn't. No one saw her much, but everyone knew that Mrs. Brubaker was crazy about keeping things clean and tidy. I'm sure she didn't own a dog."
"Maybe it was a neighbor's dog," said Dale, already sorry that he'd called the woman. "Coming over to check me out."
"Not if it was a small black dog,"
said Sandy.
"Mr. Johnson to your south owns 2 hounds for hunting, but they're big and brown. The Bachmans, the young family who moved into your Aunt Lena and Uncle Henry's place over toward the cemetery, they had an Irish setter, but it was killed by the milk truck last summer."
"Christ," thought Dale. "Talk about small towns."
"What kind of dog was it?"
Sandy asked again. Dale sighed. Some cows in a muddy field looked up as he drove past, and he wondered if his expression was as vague as theirs. "I don't really know dogs," he said.
"I do," said Sandy Whitaker. "I own 5 and subscribe to the AKC Journal and watch the Westminster Dog Show on satellite every year. Describe the dog and I'll tell you what kind it is."
Dale rubbed his head. It was beginning to ache. "A little thing," he said. "About 10-12 inches tall, I guess. Not much longer. Black. I thought that maybe it was a terrier."
"Did it have longer hair?"
said Sandy. "No, it didn't really have hair."
"No hair?"
said Sandy. She sounded shocked, as if he'd said something obscene. "I mean, really short hair," said Dale. "Very short, black."
"Well, American Staffordshire Terriers and Toy Terriers and Pit Bull Terriers and Boston Terriers and their type all have very short hair,"
Sandy said dubiously.
"But none of them are all black, and no one in the county owns any of those breeds. Did you see the dog's head?"
"Sort of," said Dale.
"Was the snout long, thin, or sort of pushed in?"
"Sort of pushed in, I think," said Dale. He had to grin. He felt like a crime witness being grilled by a relentless cop. "Sort of like a bulldog's."
"Hmm,"
said Sandy Whitaker, sounding judicious.
"American bulldogs and old English bulldogs are larger than you described, unless you saw a puppy."
"I don't think it was a puppy," said Dale, no longer sure what he'd seen.
"Then it could have been a pug or a French bulldog. Was it slim and sleek, or did it have a sort of barrel chest?"
Dale was tempted to close his eyes to remember. A pickup passed the other way. Dale kept his eyes open. "It did sort of have a barrel chest. Powerful, and little tiny legs, but solid. Not like one of those ratty little chihuahuas." There were several seconds of silence.
2 of my 5 dogs are chihuahuas, Dale."
Dale rolled his eyes. "Well, gosh, thanks for your help, Sandy."
"What kind of tail did this black dog have?"
she asked, all business now.
Tail? He called back the memory of the little dog's black ass retreating toward the chicken coop. I didn't see a tail. I don't think it had a tail.
Pugs have curled tails that sort of sit up on their backs, said Sandy Whittaker. What about this dog's ears? Were they flat or raised?
Raised, said Dale, not really caring any longer. Triangular. They stuck up.
Then it's not a pug, Sandy Whittaker said. Their ears curled down. Do you remember anything else about the black dog?
It had sort of a pink splotch on its face, muzzle, whatever, said Dale. He was almost to the outskirts of Oak Hill. He could just stop by Sandy Whittaker's office if he wanted. He had no intention of doing so.
Yes,
said the woman.
It sounds like a French bulldog. They grow about 12 inches tall, weigh about 25 pounds. They have a pug-like face, barrel chest, and pointy ears. And they have a broad, short, stubby nose with slanting nostrils and a pink flush to their muzzle.
Well, thanks, Sandy. You've been a big help.
The only problem,
interrupted Sandy Whittaker,
is that French bulldogs come in fawn coloring. Pied, that's black and white. Red brindle and black brindle, that's sort of reddish and black. Never a pure black. Are you sure that the dog you saw wasn't pied?
Absolutely, positively, coal black, thought Dale with absolute positive certainty. It could have been pied, I guess, he said. Well, thanks again, Sandy. You've really...
The other problem with the French bulldog,
said Sandy Whittaker,
is that there aren't any around here. Not in Elm Haven, not in Oak Hill, not anywhere around here, not even on any of the farms in your part of the county. I would have noticed.
After confronting C.J. Congdon in the garage and paying for the new tires, Dale drove back to the farm. He had always hated confrontations, especially confrontations with any sort of authority, but rather than being rattled by the encounter, he found himself slightly amused by it, and the previous night's sense of being displaced far from the center of things, even from himself, had receded. He had his truck back, the farmhouse was full of food and drink, and if he wanted, he could drive west or east any time he wanted. Things looked better, but the weather did not. Dark clouds were moving in from the west. The warm autumn day slid slowly but inexorably into a winterish chill. He was almost back to Elm Haven when he noticed how low he was on gas. There was nothing for it, he thought. He had to deal with the quick and easy. It was raining when he got to the gas station, convenience store. Trucks hissed past on I-74 just down the slope. Dale pumped the gas and cleaned his windows. There was no pay-at-the-pump option, so he took out his American Express card and walked into the store to pay. Derek, the skinhead nephew, looked up from behind the counter. He was wearing a brown and orange quick and easy shirt and a cap with the company logo on it. His face froze when he saw Dale. Dale laughed out loud.
"What's so fucking funny?" said the boy.
Dale shook his head and set cash down instead of his credit card. "Derek," he said, "the day just keeps getting better and better." The day got worse and worse. The clouds lowered, the breeze turned into a windstorm, and the temperature dropped 40 degrees by nightfall. That evening, Dale retreated early to the relative warmth of the basement to read in Duane's old bed and listen to the old-time radio station being picked up by the big console radio. Outside, the wind howled. Inside, the wind howled. Dale lowered his book and listened to the sound. First a whistling, then dropping suddenly to a bass growl. He walked from one of the high windows to the next, checking for cracks or broken panes, but the sound was not coming from any of the windows. It was coming from the darkened coal bin behind the furnace. Dale took out the Dunhill lighter that Claire had given him, flicked it on, and peered into the lightless hole. There had been a hanging light there once, but the bulb had long since been removed. The noise was very loud in the small space. Dale stepped up into the coal bin and moved the lighter flame in a circle, looking at the floor and walls. Traces of coal dust remained on the concrete floor all these decades later. The gap where the coal hopper had been, before Mr. McBride had switched to gas, had been bricked up, as had the opening to the coal chute itself. There were no windows in the cramped space. There was a huge square board, probably 4 feet by 4 feet, screwed into the bricks on the west wall. The howling was coming from there. Dale bent low to cross to the west wall. He set his hand against the thick square of plywood. The wood pulsed as if something on the other side was pushing back. Cold air gusted through chinks along the top of the rotted wood, and the howl returned, then rose to a whistle. It took Dale only a minute to use his fingers to pry the old screws out of the decaying mortar between the bricks. Parts of the wood splintered when he pulled the barricade back and away. Cold air blew freely now, carrying with it the dank stench of cold earth. The smell of the grave. Dale held his flickering lighter forward, throwing pale light down what had to be a tunnel, perhaps 3 feet wide, almost 4 feet tall. Corrugated red earth and stone were visible for 25 feet or more to a dirt wall where the tunnel either ended or dog-legged to the right. It can't end there. The wind's coming from somewhere. Dale considered exploring the tunnel for a full 2 milliseconds. No way was he going crawling into that wet, half-caved-in hole in the ground. Bringing a screwdriver, hammer, and nails from the workbench in the basement, Dale set the barricade back in place, reset the long screws in the crumbling mortar as best he could, and then drove in 10 of the longest nails he could find. The wind continued to push and pulse against the wood, whistling through the splintered gap at the top. Replacing the tools and washing his hands in the basement utility sink, Dale thought, what the hell is that? Where does it go? He was almost asleep an hour later, the wind having dropped and been replaced by a heavy, sleety rain, when he remembered the bootlegger's cave. Every summer during his 4 years in Elmhaven, Dale and his brother Lawrence had joined Mike and Kevin and Harlan and Bob McCown and some of the other town kids in searching Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's property north of the cemetery for the legendary bootlegger's cave. A combination of underground speakeasy and liquor depot rumored to have been operated up County 6 during Prohibition. None of the kids knew what Prohibition had been, exactly, but that did not keep them from digging holes all over Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's hillsides in search of the legendary cave. Many of the old-timers swore that the bootleggers had operated out of their cave somewhere up County 6, always on the lookout for revenuers. None of the boys had a clue what revenuers were, but it sounded scary to them as well. By the time the bike patrol kids started digging up Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's property for the first time in the summer of 1959, the legend of the bootlegger's cave had become gospel and had grown to include a complete speakeasy buried somewhere under those hills, complete with several Prohibition-era cars entombed there, hundreds of barrels of whiskey, and possibly a dead gangster or two. Dale and his friends had moved several tons of soil in the fruitless search. But Duane almost never joined them on those outings. Dale had always thought that it was because the fat boy did not want to work at the digging. But Duane worked harder on his farm than any of the city kids, so one day Dale had asked him why he didn't want to find the bootlegger's cave with them. "You're looking in the wrong place," Duane had said. Dale had ridden his bike out to Duane's farm alone. Lawrence was in bed with the flu, and Duane's old man had sent Dale up to one of the high, hot lofts in the barn, where his genius friend was busy writing what looked like hieroglyphics on the barn wall. It turned out that they were hieroglyphics. Duane had decided to become religious and worship some Egyptian god or goddess, but Dale hadn't been interested in that right then. Even though Duane had accumulated quite a treasure trove of animal and bird skulls at his makeshift altar in the loft, Dale wanted to know about the bootlegger's cave. "What do you mean you're looking in the wrong place?" "And for the wrong thing," continued Duane, dabbing white paint on his row of bird and eyeball and wavy line hieroglyphics.
"What do you mean?" "The bootleggers didn't have a cave, just one of these farmhouses with an escape tunnel they dug. The tunnel's not even that long."
"How do you know?"
"They used our house," said Duane.
"You've seen this tunnel?"
"I haven't been in it."
"Where would we dig for it?"
"You don't have to dig. It runs right out of the basement of the Jolly Corner."
"And are there cars and stuff in it, like dead guys?"
Duane had laughed and rubbed his nose with the paintbrush.
I don't think so. More like rats and sewage. I doubt if the gangsters dug a very good tunnel. It must go right by where the old outhouse used to be.
Dale had wrinkled his nose.
That isn't the bootlegger's cave. The real cave is huge, with cars in it and stuff, and lots of whiskey. We're pretty sure it's down by the creek on Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's farm.
Duane had shrugged, and that had been the end of it. Dale had never asked him about it again. Now, more than 40 years later, Dale went to sleep smiling at the memory. He did not hear the scratching that had replaced the howl of the wind. A scratching coming from the darkness behind the furnace, where the opening to the coal bin was.
10.
During the next few weeks at the farm, the first 3 weeks of November, Dale began to enjoy himself. It was a brief respite before the nightmare. It turned out that almost all of the disadvantages of the place and situation worked to his advantage in one way or another. The lousy weather, the warm fall days lasted only a day or two more before the snow and gray skies returned, kept him inside and drove him deeper into himself in that indefinable way so important to writers. And writing was what this so-called sabbatical was all about. Dale was using my old notebooks to retrieve the sense of being 11 years old in the Elm Haven of the summer of 1960. He had never clearly expressed to himself his goal of writing a book about that summer, or even of finally recapturing clear memories of that time, but this is what he proceeded to do in the weeks after his arrival at the Jolly Corner. At first, the lack of connection there, no telephone, no internet, no television, almost gave him a sense of vertigo. Despite his previous discipline as a writer and academic, he was still used to being connected. But as the days turned into weeks, the silence, especially the mental silence that comes from not being hammered by email and phone calls, turned first into a pleasant advantage and then into a necessity. He thought of making the occasional call when in Oak Hill or Elm Haven to his agent, to his daughters, but he did not need to make the phone calls and soon found reason to forget them. He found a newspaper kiosk in Elm Haven and occasionally bought the Peoria Journal Star, ostensibly for national news, although it was the provincial Peoria and rural news that really caught his attention. More frequently, often after writing for hours, he would come down into the basement where I used to sleep and listen to one of the radios there, relaxing on my bed and listening to distant St. Louis's one good jazz station, much in the way that I used to spend hot summer nights listening to Cardinals and Cubs games, the voices rising and falling across the static of the breathing Earth's ionosphere, the sense of distance and space implicit in the ambiguities of the reception. Most of the time, however, Dale Stewart celebrated his isolation. The weirdness of the house, the phantom light on the sealed-off second floor, and the encounters with skinheads and a former bully bemused him more than concerned him. It gave a flavor of strangeness without the harshness of real threat. It kept him inward turned and progress aimed. He began to take walks. After decades living in the American West, where the view is everything, where the scope and scale of nature is all but overwhelming, Dale found great satisfaction in finding a modest view from the small hill a quarter of a mile behind the barn, the flat area where I had buried my dog, Wittgenstein, more than 40 years earlier, although Dale did not know that, and then following the frozen creek south another three-quarters of a mile to the Johnson small woods. The gray skies and flat vistas seemed to make the scale of nature smaller here, more accessible, more observable, and Dale soon began to walk an hour or two each day despite the harsh weather, sometimes heading back up the creek toward the farm or cutting across the frozen fields. Dale could not even see the farmhouse until the last few hundred yards, the barn appearing first, looming out of the snow and gloom, then the rusted oval of the fueling station gas tank hanging in its iron girders, then the washed-out, pale box of the house solidifying in the flat light. He would make himself lunch, usually soup and French bread and some cheese, and then return to my old man's study with its roll-top desk, bookcases, sleigh bed, and decent light. There he'd work, typing on his ThinkPad for several more hours,
often printing out the day's work on the compact HP LaserJet printer he'd brought along so that he could edit and revise the hard copy in the evening or the next morning. Then dinner, usually something more substantial than soup and bread, and another hour or two of writing before spending the evening reading or going to the basement to listen to jazz through the console radio's scratchy but wonderful speaker. Dale was writing easily, but not well. Both his academic background and commercial writing experience had trained him to start from the outside in. That is, to structure the tale, research the characters and settings, and then write inward, the way a whittler carves a shape from a stick. I was just a kid when I died, but I had already discovered one important truth about writing. To do it well, one has to work from the inside out. That is, there has to be a quiet but unshakable center to the tale, whether in the core of the characters or the story, or preferably in both, and everything must spiral outward from that point. Dale was still whittling away, trying not to cut across the grain and hoping to find honest shapes in the wood. His sense of place in the unformed novel was very strong. What, after all, is more real to us than the geography of our childhoods? Occasionally he would get in the Land Cruiser and drive slowly through the streets of Elmhaven to refresh himself on some item of geography, but in truth he wasn't writing about the sad and battered Elmhaven of this shoddy new century. Dale was living in the summer of 1960 now, and when he drove the streets of the little town he was looking at structures and people who were no longer there, who would never be there again. Dale had no guilt at borrowing my own journals of jottings and vignettes and character scribbles to capture the kids of the summer of 1960, including himself. After my death, Dale had promised himself that he would become the writer that his friend Duane had wanted to be, so it seemed natural that he would build on my old notes and observations to write this particular book, but they were my notes and observations, not Dale's. He still had not discovered his own key to the door opening on that largely forgotten summer, so when he began the early chapter descriptions of our 11-year-old friends, Michael Rourke, Kevin Grumbacher, Jim Harlan, Donna Lou Perry, Cordy Cook, and the others, they were my perceptions and misperceptions, not Dale's. Not even the images of young Dale himself and of his little brother Lawrence came completely from Dale. Perhaps he was afraid to go back to those memories all by himself. The black dog returned 19 days after he arrived. It was late afternoon, and Dale was taking his favorite walk, heading west to the flat rise, following the creek south to the woods on Mr. Johnson's farm, then cutting northeast along a gully coming out at Cavalry Cemetery on County Road 6. Then it was less than a mile along the gravel road to the driveway back to the farmhouse. This afternoon, he had just reached the woods and was preparing to cross the creek before hiking east when he saw the dog, 20 yards or so behind him, on the same side of the creek cut. When Dale stopped, the dog stopped. For a moment he was sure that he had solved the tiny mystery. If the dog was here in the Johnson's woods, then the dog must belong to Mr. Johnson. But then Dale realized that the hound had followed him from Duane's farm. Dale took a few steps toward the dog. The small black dog retreated a few steps, then turned and waited. Dale stood looking at it, wishing that he'd brought his binoculars. The black dog appeared a bit larger than he remembered it, but the rest of his description to Sandy Whitaker still applied. A relatively small dog, all black except for a patch of pink on its flattened muzzle, floppy ears, no tail visible, and barrel-chested. He tried to remember the breed that Sandy had mentioned, a French bulldog? The dog waited for Dale to begin walking again before it followed. Dale slid down the steep creek bank and jumped the narrow, half-frozen stream. The dog picked its way across 20 yards to the north and scrambled up the steep slope. Dale followed his usual route back to County 6, following old cow paths along the rim of a narrow ridge that ran between two gullies. The stream in the south gully had been named Corpse Creek by Dale and his buddies 45 years earlier. There had been a 3-foot-deep pool on the east side of the gravel road where the creek ran through a tall culvert, a favorite hiding place for the boys, and frequently dead animals hit by speeding cars on County 6 had ended up in the pool, thus Corpse Creek. The black dog stayed 20 yards back, picking its way across frozen grass in that tender-footed way that some dogs have outdoors. At one point,
Dale stopped and threw a rock in the dog's general direction, not trying to hit it, merely trying to get it to go away. The black dog sat on its haunches and stared at him. Then the dog licked its muzzle and showed its teeth. Not, Dale thought, in any sort of snarl, merely in a doggy grin. Dale felt a chill of unease flow through him. He knew it must be a trick of the overcast day and distance, but for an instant it looked as if the black dog's teeth were wrong. It looked as if the dog had human teeth. Dale shook his head, angry at himself for generating the image, and when he looked back, the dog was no longer showing any teeth. He climbed over Johnson's wire fence at a sturdy fence post and walked out onto the asphalt of County 6 in front of the Hilltop Cemetery. It was a cold day and windy. Usually the cemetery was empty of visitors during Dale's weekday afternoon walks, but he realized with a start that this day someone was standing 30 or 40 yards into the graveyard. The lone figure was male and oddly dressed, wearing what appeared to be high leather boots, khaki wool, as in old military uniforms, and a Boy Scout-type broad-brimmed hat. An old veteran? Thought Dale. It was impossible to tell the age of the man at this distance, but the slimness and suppleness of his silhouette suggested someone younger. There was no car in the grass parking berm along the black iron fence. The man in the cemetery looked up from the headstone he was contemplating and stared in Dale's direction. Dale waved. He wondered if it was someone local, perhaps the male half of the young couple who had bought Uncle Henry and Aunt Lena's farm, or someone else who lived within walking distance of the cemetery. It would be nice to meet someone normal around Elm Haven. The man stared, but did not wave back. Dale mentally shrugged and began his walk north down the steep incline, making sure, as always, that no car or pickup was roaring down behind him on the narrow asphalt road. When he thought to check, there was no sign of the black dog.
It was an hour later, after he'd finished some tomato soup and returned to his computer in the study, that he realized that someone had been in the house.
The IBM ThinkPad had been left on. The last sentence Dale had typed was still on the screen. The summer lies ahead like a great banquet, and the days are filled with rich, slow time in which to enjoy each course. Dale had thought about that sentence during his walk and decided that the simile might be too flowery, but it was not the possible excess in the writing that concerned him now. Below his sentence had been typed,
"Gabble wretchets yeth wished hounds, he heft a hundes hefed, and his locus whereon o for he mot sida, and his egg on sheenon swa lota swa morgen stura, and his teth whereon swa sharpa swa a foros texas."
He didn't pay any attention to the gibberish yet. He was more interested in who had written it. Dale reached under the sleigh bed in the study and pulled out the new baseball bat he'd put there. The crowbar was heavier, but it was in the kitchen cupboard. Hefting the bat, walking as lightly as he could, Dale went down the hall to the kitchen, through the kitchen, and out onto the side stoop. It had begun to rain again, but it was light enough for him to see the muddy turnaround area. It had been wet and muddy before he left. The only car tracks led to his parked Land Cruiser. The only footprints were the ones he had left coming and going. Not satisfied, Dale went back into the house. He traded the bat for the crowbar, locked the door, and went from room to room, switching on lights as he went. He checked behind furniture and drapes and under the bed. He opened closets. He went down the basement stairs and checked behind the furnace and under Duane's old brass bed. He checked the empty coal bin. Upstairs again, he rechecked all of the ground floor rooms. Then he went up the stairs to the second floor. The heavy plastic remained stapled firmly in place. The second floor hallway was dim behind the yellowed sheets of construction plastic. Dale checked everything again. Nothing. No one. The house was so empty and silent that the sound of the furnace kicking on made him jump and hold the crowbar at port arms. He retrieved the baseball bat and went back to the study, hoping that the words would be gone from his screen. They were still there. Dale sighed, sat in the old swivel chair, and printed out the page.
As he saw it, there were only two possibilities. Either someone had been in the house while he was walking, or he had typed these lines without being conscious of it. Either possibility made him slightly ill. He looked at the first line.
Gobble wretchets, yeth wished hounds.
The word hounds leaped out of the line. Whoever had typed this mess had not taken time to hit the space bar. Dale went through the manuscript with his blue pen, setting diagonal slashes where he thought the breaks should be. The message became,
Gobble wretchets, yeth wished hounds, a heft a hundes heffed, and his locus weron o for hemot sida, and his egen shinon swalota swa morgen stura, and his teth weron swa sharpa swa aforas texas.
Unfortunately, most of it made sense to the English professor. Dale Stewart's expertise was in 20th century literature, but he had taught his share of Chaucer and enjoyed his seminars on Beowulf. This old English was closer to Beowulf's. Gobble wretchets rang vague bells but did not immediately translate. He didn't believe that was old English. Welsh, perhaps. Yeth meant heath, so the end of the first line meant something like heath or wished hounds. He would have to check references for the wished. The rest of the message was straight old English.
He heft a hundes heffed.
He had the head of a hound. Dale lowered the paper and rubbed his cheek, hearing the stubble there scrape. His hand was shaking, ever so slightly.
And his locus weron o for hemot sida.
And his locks were extremely long. Dale smiled. When he had first seen the typing, he'd been afraid that Derek and the other skinheads, or even Sheriff C.J. Congdon, had sneaked into the place to spook him. He felt he could safely rule them out. He doubted if any of the locals he'd met so far were literate in Old English. Careful, Dale, old boy, he warned himself. Intellectual pride goeth before a fall.
And his egen shinon swa lota swa morgen stura.
And his eyes shone as bright as the morning star. Someone with the head of a hound, long locks and blazing eyes. Lovely.
And his teth weron swa sharpa swa a forest Texas.
Texas. Dale wished it was a note about Texas. This line translated as, and his teeth were as sharp as a boar's tusks. Texas. Dale deleted the lines of Old English and tried to get back to his novel, but somehow he could not transport himself back to the rich summer vacation of 1960. After a while he gave up, pulled a cold beer from the fridge, grabbed his dog-eared copy of Norton's Anthology, found the Beowulf section, and went down to the basement where it was brighter and warmer. He turned on the console radio and listened to the scratchy jazz coming from St. Louis. As he skimmed over Beowulf, the last of the day's light faded and died through the windows high on the cement wall. The furnace came on with its wheeze and roar, but Dale was too lost in the Beowulf tale to notice. The monster Grendel and his mother, not to mention the wolves circling close around the beleaguered mead hall, were described several times by the word werg, or its variant, wer. A marginal note in Dale's own hand read, German form varg, wolf, but also denotes outlaw, someone who has committed a crime that is unforgivable or unredeemable. Then, next to his note, in Claire's slanting script, those cast out from their communities and doomed to wander and die alone. Warg equals corpse worrier, from Indo-European werg, to strangle, equals one who deserves strangulation. The outcast human warg could be killed on sight with impunity. Dale's hands were shaking again as he lowered the heavy anthology. He'd forgotten that he'd loaned Claire his text when she'd audited his Beowulf graduate class 4 years ago. Dimly, slowly, Dale became aware of the blues song being played on the old radio.
It was as if someone had turned up the volume. He dropped the book and reversed positions on the bed, leaning closer to the glowing dial. It was a powerful and classic piece of blues. Legend said that the composer-player, Robert Johnson, had sold his soul to the devil to be able to write and play such music. Johnson had never denied the rumors. Dale closed his eyes and listened to the ancient recording of Johnson wailing to the tune of "Hellhound on My Trail." 11.
2 weeks after Claire Hart joined Dale's 20th Century American Authors class, and a week before they became lovers, Dale, Dr. Stewart, had her stay a few minutes after the seminar ended.
It was a beautiful early autumn day that felt like summer, and the windows to the old classroom were open, looking out onto green leaves and blue sky. "You're Claire Two Hearts," said Dale, "Mona Two Hearts' daughter." Claire frowned at him.
"How did you find out?"
"Some supplementary transcripts arrived from the university in Florence, and your real name was on them, unlike the earlier transcripts. Your mother's name was also on one of the documents."
Claire stood silent, looking at him. He was soon to learn just how still and silent this young woman could be.
After a moment, Dale cleared his throat and went on. "I apologize. I mean, I really wasn't snooping, but I was just curious why..."
"Why I hid my identity?"
Dale nodded. Claire had smiled without warmth.
"Dr. Stewart, it isn't easy being a famous diva's daughter, not even in Italy, and that part of my identity had no role in my graduate work here."
Dale nodded. "I knew that your mother had grown up on the Blackfeet Reservation up north."
"Actually, she didn't," said Claire,
in that no-nonsense tone that he'd already grown to enjoy in class.
"All of Mama's press kits say that she grew up poor on the reservation, not far from St. Mary, but in reality she was born there but grew up in Cutbank, Great Falls, Billings, and half a dozen other little towns before she went on to Juilliard and then on to Europe."
Claire looked him straight in the eye.
"Mama's mother had married a white man who was ashamed of the res. I'm part half-breed."
Dale shook his head at that. "Miss Hart, I really didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just noticed the difference in names, recognized your mother's name. I thought that I should tell you about the supplementary transcripts."
"Does anyone else know?"
asked Claire. "I don't think so. I just happened to see the file on the day that the transcripts came in because we were trying to allocate credits for the non-degree graduate students." He pulled the file out of his drawer, removed the telltale transcripts, and handed them to her. "I'll refile the rest," he said. "The supplements weren't necessary." Claire slid the papers into her backpack without looking at them and turned to go. She stopped at the door and looked back at him. He expected to hear a "thank you," but what she said was,
"I've been in Missoula for almost a month, but I haven't had the nerve to drive up to the reservation."
Dale had amazed himself by saying, "I go up to Glacier and the reservation every fall. I could show you around there if you want." Claire had looked at him with that neutral, intense stare of hers, and then turned and left without another word. Later, after he came to know her as well as he could, perhaps as well as anyone could, he realized that she had probably decided to have an affair with him at that moment. Dale awakens to a loud banging. He looks around. He is in the study. He'd fallen asleep in the chair, and with the exception of the single desk lamp, the farmhouse is dark. He does not remember dozing off or what he was working on here when he fell asleep. The ThinkPad is turned off. The banging is coming from upstairs. "To hell with this!" Dale is suddenly very angry. He looks around for the baseball bat, but he's left it in another room where it has rolled under the bed. The banging intensifies. Dale leaves the lighted study and walks down the darkened hallway, up the narrow steps. A pale light glows through the yellowed plastic. He pulls out his pocket knife, selects the sharpest blade, and makes rough incisions through the plastic, diagonally. X marks the spot. He tears at the layers of brittle plastic with his hands until he rips a hole, widens it, tears plastic from the frame. The air wafts out from behind the plastic, and it carries the scent of lilacs and decay. Tutankhamun's tomb. Dale steps through the torn plastic, feeling the strands of the brittle stuff trying to hold him back. And then he is standing on the faded runner in the upstairs hallway, the stale air still rushing past him and downstairs as though he had opened an airlock. There is one open door on his right, two on the left. The light is coming from the rear room on the left. The banging has stopped. Still holding his small utility knife, Dale strides down the hall, pausing to glance in the first room on his left and the open door to his right, a small bedroom to his left, an even smaller bathroom to his right. Both rooms are dark. The light from the rear bedroom flickers like candlelight. Pausing in the doorway, Dale peers around the doorframe. A tall bed, a massive chest of drawers, a low dressing table with an opaque mirror, a flickering kerosene lamp on the dressing table, and a hand-built closet, painted a faded yellow, that seems strangely familiar to Dale. The windows are so heavily curtained and draped that no hint of moonlight or sunlight could find its way in. Holding the pathetic little knife ahead of him, Dale crosses to the bed. There is a dark outline there on the age-tarnished quilt. At first Dale thinks it is a figure. Then he sees it is merely an indentation in the quilt, but as he steps up to the high bed, he sees that it is more than an indentation. The center of the bed has sagged into a deep hole shaped in the form of a man. Or of a corpse laid out there. Even the pillow is dented down a foot or more into the mattress, the hole shaped like the oval of a human head. Dale hears the slightest noise from the deep indentation and leans over the bed, trying to ignore the stench, the same death smell he had encountered on his first moments in the house, and wishing that he had brought a flashlight. The bottom of the human-shaped pit in the mattress is crawling and oozing with life. Maggots.
Worms.
Dale backs away, holding his free hand to his mouth, glancing behind him at the dark hallway. The old oil lamp flickers, as if to a strong breeze, the light almost going out but then steadying at the lowest glimmer. The banging resumes, louder, wilder, more insistent. It is coming from the hand-built closet in the corner. Dale looks at the closet and realizes that it is a huge coffin, crudely painted yellow and set on end. The door splinters and begins to open as he watches. Dale awoke to a loud banging. He sat up. He was not in the study, but in the basement, the heavy Norton anthology lying next to him on Duane's old bed. The console radio was still whispering static and music. It was not night. Mid-morning light shone through the narrow windows at the top of the basement wall. The banging resumed. Dale looked around for the crowbar or baseball bat and remembered that he had left both of them upstairs last evening. He shook his head, ran his fingers through his tousled hair, and went up the steps and through the kitchen toward the banging. Michelle Staffney was knocking at the side door. Dale rubbed his face and opened the inner door.
"Dale, I hope you don't mind that I dropped by."
She looked him up and down. Dale shook his head and stepped back, welcoming her into the kitchen.
"Uh-uh," he said. "Sorry for the way I look, but I must have fallen asleep last night. I was downstairs I didn't really go to bed last night. I fell asleep reading and listening to music. What time is it, Micah?"
"Michelle will do," said the redhead with a slight smile. "And it's about 9:30. I guess you were tired."
"Yeah," said Dale. He crossed to the refrigerator. "Like some orange juice?"
"Sure."
"Take your jacket off. Just set it on the chair there. Do you want some breakfast?"
"No, thanks, Dale. I already ate. I just wanted to give you an invitation. I would have called, but..."
Dale handed her a jelly glass half-filled with orange juice.
"Yeah," he said, "it's sort of hard to get in touch with me by phone."
The taste of the orange juice helped reduce the buzzing in his head. He felt hungover, but didn't remember drinking more than one lousy beer the previous evening. "Invitation?" he said.
"For Thanksgiving," said Michelle Staffney.
Dale motioned to the kitchen table, and the two sat across from one another. The morning light was weak through the windows. Another gray day.
"Thanksgiving?" said Dale.
"Next Thursday," said Michelle.
"I hadn't planned to be here this long, but it looks as if I will. I don't know anyone else around here, and I thought that we could, well, hell, I don't know, cook a turkey together, drink some wine, I don't know."
"So, are you and your friend throwing a party? I'm sorry, I forget her name," said Dale.
"Diane Villanova," said Michelle, and looked down at the table. "No, Diane headed back to California yesterday. I just thought it would be nice if you and I mean, that we not spend Thanksgiving alone. But I bet you're headed somewhere or expecting someone."
"Sorry, bad idea, Dale."
"No, no," Dale said hurriedly. "I didn't even know that Thanksgiving was coming up. I've sort of been ignoring the calendar. Are you sure it's next Thursday?"
"Pretty sure," said Michelle.
"I'd love to have turkey together," said Dale. Well, not really, he thought. It would just remind him of Anne and the girls. The girls would be home from college, and of holidays past and holidays lost. Something must have showed in his expression. Michelle said,
"It's probably a dumb idea. In fact, my kitchen's all torn up, and I'm not even sure I can get it in working order by Thursday. Diane and I had planned... well, this was a dumb idea."
Dale didn't know what kind of falling out the two women had suffered, or why Michelle had remained here in Illinois, but he did know that he'd been a boor. He stood up, showing energy and enthusiasm he didn't feel at the moment, and walked over to pat the huge old stove.
"Let's cook it here," he said brightly. "Otherwise, I'll never use anything but the burners on this damn thing. I'm tired of soup.
I'd love to share a turkey with you on Thursday." Michelle nodded, but in a distracted way.
"Are you all right, Dale?"
"Sure. Don't I look all right?"
"Well, I don't know you, of course, but you seem tired."
He shrugged. "Haven't been sleeping too well, and then last night, Zonko."
"I have some sleeping pills," said Michelle, obviously making an offer. "Prescription. Plenty of them."
Dale held up his hand.
"I have a prescription, too. It knocks me out eventually, but gives me shitty dreams."
He paused.
The yellow coffin closet.
He remembered now where he'd seen it before. Their old house in Elmhaven had had such a closet in the room where he and Lawrence had slept.
"Dale?"
Michelle stood and walked over next to him.
"Sorry, I just remembered the nightmare I was having before I woke up."
He found himself telling her about it, keeping his voice light.
"My God," said Michelle, not at all amused. "Is the upstairs here really sealed off like that?"
"Come on," said Dale. "I'll show you."
Before they got to the stairway, he was suddenly and absolutely certain that the plastic would be torn and ripped where he had opened it, that a dim light would be burning at the end of the hall, that the air blowing out through the ripped plastic would smell of a tomb, and that there would be a dark figure standing at the head of the stairs. The plastic was solid and secure in its frame. Only pale sunlight showed through the yellowed membrane.
"This is really spooky,"
said Michelle. She backed down the steps, one hand on the railing, as if not wanting to turn her back on the sealed doorway. Back in the kitchen, she said,
"What do you think's up there?"
Dale shrugged.
"What do you say we work up our courage after dinner on Thursday? A lot of glasses of wine, maybe. And we end the evening by going up there and cutting that wall of plastic away and exploring the second floor."
Michelle smiled, and Dale suddenly remembered the days and years of his longing for her in 4th through 8th grade.
"It'll take more than wine to give me that much courage."
"We can arrange that," said Dale, smiling. He thought, "What the hell am I saying? The last thing I want right now is to be flirting with some woman."
Michelle walked to the door, tugging on her jacket as she went. "I'll talk to you before I buy the turkey. Oh, I forgot I can't call."
"I'll call you," said Dale. "My cell phone works when I get out of this part of the county. Here, give me your number again."
He handed her a pencil and yellow pad from the counter. She scribbled the number, nodded, and went back out to her pickup truck. She started the engine, but then rolled down the window. Dale leaned out from the stoop to hear her. It had started to rain.
"I forgot to tell you," she said. "I almost ran over your black dog on the way in. It just stood in the driveway looking at the house, not even turning around when I honked the horn. I had to drive around it on the grass."
Dale shook his head. "Not my black dog. It's just been hanging around here. A black pooch with pink on its muzzle, right? Real small, maybe 10-12 inches tall."
"Black with pink on its snout," agreed Michelle. "But not that small. It must have been a couple of feet tall. Big chest."
"Too big to be the black dog that I've seen," said Dale. "Must be its big brother." Michelle nodded.
"Well, see you on Thanksgiving."
She sounded a bit uncertain, now that it had been planned. Dale smiled. "Talk to you on the phone before then." She waved and drove down the lane in the rain. There was no sign of the black dog. Dale went back in to turn up the heat and make some breakfast. He decided to splurge and have some bacon, and was draining the grease from the pan, setting out a paper towel to blot the bacon itself, when a loud voice came from his study.
"You've got mail."
12.
"Welcome back, Dale."
Dale stood in the study staring at the screen of his IBM ThinkPad. There was nothing unsettling about receiving an email except for the fact that A, the modem was not currently connected to a cell phone or to any phone line, B, the message had not come through his AOL account, and C, the computer was not even running in Windows. Somehow the computer had exited to DOS and the message had been typed directly after the C prompt.
Then where the hell did the "You've Got Mail" voice come from? It had been the AOL voice, there was no mistake about that.
Dale came closer to the desk and studied the computer. Had he turned it on? Or off? The previous evening before going down to the basement and falling asleep while listening to the radio? He couldn't remember. The message burned white against the black screen. Without touching the keyboard, Dale checked the serial ports, the PCM CIA slots, and the other connections. He knew that more and more computers and PDAs were operating wirelessly these days, but as far as he knew, his older ThinkPad didn't have that capability, and even if it did, it would require Windows and his AOL account for him to receive or send mail. He subscribed to no other ISPs and had long ago deleted the other internet alternatives that had been bundled with his laptop.
Which means that someone typed this directly onto the screen.
Dale sat, keeping his fingers away from the keyboard, looking over his shoulder.
Did Michelle come in here during her visit?
They had gone up the stairs together to look at the plastic sheeting, but Dale could not remember her being out of his sight at any time.
Someone could have come in the house during the night. The door was unlocked this morning.
That seemed more probable, but why this silly welcome note? Why not just steal the computer and be done with it? And where the hell did the AOL "You've Got Mail" voice come from? Dale was not terribly techno-savvy, but he'd been writing with and grading on and internet researching with computers long enough to know that the AOL sounds were stored in wave file form on the computer itself. So if someone wanted to activate it, all they would have to do would be... But why? What kind of joke is this?
Dale sat staring for several more minutes, waiting for another line of letters to appear. None did.
Sighing, he tapped Enter and typed on the next line, "Thanks." Then he went back to the kitchen to reheat the bacon and make some toast. He had just carried the plate of toast and bacon to the table and was sipping his coffee when he heard,
"You've got mail."
This time he walked through the other ground floor rooms with crowbar in hand before entering the study. Even from 6 feet away, he could read the screen.
"You're welcome, Dale."
Dale realized that he was breathing shallowly and that his heart was pounding. He took some deep breaths before sitting and typing, Who are you?
He sat there another 10 minutes, watching the screen and waiting, but no new words appeared. A watched pot, he thought, and lifted the crowbar and went back into the kitchen, locking the outside door. His coffee and food were cold, but he ate and drank anyway, listening all the while. After 5 minutes or so, he peeked into the study. No new words were on the screen. He had just carried his plate over to the sink and was rinsing it when he heard, "You've got mail!" Dale ran into the study, forgetting the crowbar.
Bar guest.
Dale laughed out loud. What kind of self-respecting ghost would identify itself as a bar guest? That was the kind of stupid screen name that hackers and techno geeks love to go by. He typed, "Where are you emailing from, bar guest?" This time he waited a stubborn 15 minutes, wanting to see words appear on the screen, but nothing happened. Finally, he lifted the baseball bat out from under the bed and went downstairs to check the basement. He'd finished looking in all of the dark corners and hidden spaces when he heard the familiar AOL voice upstairs announcing email. Familiarity may not always breed contempt, but it does lessen fear of the unusual. Dale was more curious than anxious when he walked into the study to see what the uninvited hacker had to say.
Thera thurda, ser men habath, hunda hefod, and of thera urthan, on thera etan men hisselfa.
Dale felt the flesh above his spine go cold. Bar guest sounded like some young hacker screen name, all right, but how many teenage hackers knew Old English? Dale stared at the words, forcing himself to slip into his English professor mode. From the nation where men have the head of a dog, and from the country where men devour each other. Nice. Dale didn't know where the quote was from. It sounded like a quote to him, but he knew that it wasn't from Beowulf or any of the other epics he'd taught. The country where men devour each other. Thinking of Beowulf, he looked back at the word bar guest. It wasn't in any form of Old English that he recognized, but it had that Germanic feel to it. Geist meant spirit or ghost, and bar could stand for beer, as in funeral beer. He flexed his fingers over the keyboard and took a few more deep breaths before typing, "Well, you're clever, but rude, bar guest. Speaking from ambush isn't polite. I'll chat with you if and when you tell me how you've hacked into my computer and who you are. Do you prefer modern English or old English?" This time he did not wait around. He had not quite made it to the kitchen when the voice announced new mail.
"Welcome back, Dale. But be careful. We must find what we have lost. Cerberus der Arge und Alessina Warge, die anhem heingem."
Dale exhaled slowly. If he was not mistaken, the last part of the message was Middle-High German. Dale didn't speak or read all that fluently in modern German, much less Middle-High German, but he'd been required to do some doctoral research in the language, and at least one of his colleagues had been urging him for years to study and teach certain Middle-High German epics as a prelude to Beowulf. He tried to print the page, but his printer would not go online unless he was in Windows 98, and he was sure he'd lose the DOS page if he opened Windows, so Dale grabbed a legal pad and pen and copied down everything on the screen. Beneath those notes, he translated the poem, Cerberus the Arg. Arag? Old Norse Argr, and all the Wargs, wolves, outlaws, corpse worriers, who follow him. It was strange that he had seen that Old English word Warg, derived from the German, only last night, in both his handwriting and Claire's, in the margins of his Norton's Anthologies Beowulf. His hands were shaking slightly as he turned back to the keyboard. "Enough, who the hell are you? How do you know me, and what exactly have we lost?" He walked back to the kitchen and waited, but no AOL voice summoned him back. Several times he returned to the study, saw the lines on the screen but nothing new, and then walked out of the room, pacing through the dining room with its coffin-like learning machines, standing in the living room looking out at the gray rain, even going down into the basement a while. No voice. No new message. Finally, Dale went back to the study and loaded Windows 98. He clicked on the AOL icon and tapped in his access code. The modem in the ThinkPad clicked, but the message came up, "No dial tone." Angry now, Dale went out to the Land Cruiser and dragged in his cell phone. He hooked the phone to the modem and tried again. Now the modem found a dial tone, but the legend came up, "Unable to connect to AOL number." On the phone itself, the display continued to read, "No service." He exited Windows to DOS. The screen was empty after the C prompt. He loaded Windows and AOL again, but could not get online. After 20 minutes of messing with it all, Dale ripped the phone out, exited AOL, and shut off the goddamn computer. He looked at the notes on his legal pad again. Cerberus the Arg and all the Vargs who follow him. He knew Cerberus, of course, the three-headed dog who guarded the entrance to the underworld, the infernal regions, the land of the dead, but he had no clue as to what the quote meant. Whoever this asshole hacker was, he was clever and literate, but he was still an asshole. Too agitated to try to write, Dale grabbed his parka, returning to the study for the baseball bat, and went outside for a walk. The rain had stopped and the air had actually become warmer, but a fog had rolled in. Dale guessed that he could see less than 50 feet. The black, contorted silhouette of the first dead crabapple tree along the driveway was visible, but the barn and outbuildings had disappeared. His white Land Cruiser, beaded with moisture, looked only semi-solid in the weak light and creeping fog. The eaves dripped. From somewhere in the direction of the invisible chicken coop, a dog howled. It howled again. Dale actually grinned. After hefting the baseball bat and slapping it against his palm a couple of times, he tugged the hood of his parka up and went hunting for the hound. The fog changed the straightforward little Illinois farm into a foreign country. The dog had ceased howling the instant that Dale had stepped off the side porch, and he could not be certain of directions, since the shifting walls of fog both muffled and distorted sounds. He walked toward the chicken coop. The house and his truck disappeared in rolling gray behind him. "We must find what we have lost." Aloud, speaking in a Jay Silverheels voice, Dale said into the fog, "Who is this we, white man?" His voice sounded strange and lost in the gray blankness. "We must find what we have lost." "Here, doggy, doggy, doggy," called Dale, swinging the bat in one hand. He had no intention of hitting the pooch. He'd never hurt an animal, or a human being for that matter, but he was tired of being spooked by the thing. Anne had done a lot of research on dogs before they bought Hasso, their little terrier, and she had explained how they were still pack animals, obeying a pack hierarchy, demonstrating either dominance or submission. For instance, they had never cured Hasso of licking, a classic submissive behavior most people confuse with affection. A submissive dog in the wild licks the pack leader, or those hounds above it in pack hierarchy, in order to receive food in return. This black dog probably hadn't worked out its dominance-submission issues with Dale yet. He decided that he'd help it along. "We must find what we have lost." Setting aside the royal "we" for a moment, Dale pondered that phrase. He had come here to Duane's old farm because he felt that he had lost everything. Anne and the girls, Claire, his job, the respect of his peers, his self-respect, and his ability to write, but deep down, Dale knew that this attitude was all self-pity and mummery. He still had some money in the bank. The ranch could be his again in 10 months after the renter's lease was up. He might not truly be on sabbatical, but odds favored him returning to teach at the University of Montana again next year if he so chose. He had a $50,000 sport utility vehicle parked in the farmhouse's muddy turnaround, and it was fully paid for. He was 60-some pages into a new novel, and he had a publisher who hadn't given up on him yet. No, he hadn't lost everything. Far from it. "We must find what we have lost." Perhaps it was a case of what we have lost. Not just him, but everyone in this new century, his generation at least, Writing about the 11-year-old kids in the summer of 1960 made Dale's chest ache every time he sat down at the computer, not just because of the nostalgia of that half-lost summer of so long ago, but because of some indefinable sense of loss that made him want to weep. "Yoo-hoo, dog!" called Dale, opening the door to the chicken coop. He wished that he had brought a flashlight. He stepped into the darkness and then froze, as a powerful smell struck him. "Not the smell of decay," thought Dale. "Stronger. Coppery. Fresh." He blinked in the dim light, raising the baseball bat like a club. The smell of blood. He almost left them, but he had to see. In a minute or two, his eyes adapted well enough for him to make out the long, low room of empty roosts and matted straw and splattered walls. The walls and floor had been splattered with ancient dried blood the first time he had looked in here. They were splattered with blood now, but even in the dim light he could see that it was fresh blood. Wet. Dripping. Some of it actually running down the rough boards as he watched. "Time to go," thought Dale. He backed out of the chicken coop, setting his back to the wall and raising the bat again. The fog had closed in tighter. The light had failed even more. Dale felt his heart pounding and his ears straining to make out any sound. The soft squelch of mud under boots, the movement of four-legged things. Water dripped from the eaves of the coop. From somewhere to the north, there came a loud, strangely familiar rasp of wood on metal. The big barn doors being slid open? Time to go, not just back to the farmhouse, but out of here, away from Illinois and its penny dreadful little mysteries, back to Montana, or farther east to New Hampshire or Maine, somewhere else.
No, here is where we can find what we have lost.
The thought made him stop, not just because it had come unbidden and out of context, but because it seemed to have been stated in a mental voice other than his own. Dale was striding quickly now, trying to keep his boots from being swallowed in the mud, listening hard for something moving behind or ahead of him. He was almost back to the farmhouse when he saw two huge red eyes glowing at him through the fog. A second later, a car engine started up. Not eyes, tail lights. Dale ran, bat in hand, sure that someone was stealing his truck. The tail lights glowed crimson a moment, and then shut off as the vehicle drove quickly away through the fog. Dale slid to a stop on the muddy turnaround area. His Land Cruiser was still where he'd parked it. He beeped the security system. It had been locked, but it seemed to have sunk into the mud. "God damn it!" growled Dale as he stepped closer. All four of the tires were flat. Dale assumed that they had been slashed again. Dale walked out in front of the house, bat raised to his shoulder and ready to swing. He could hear a truck driving away on County 6, moving much too quickly for the foggy conditions. There were tracks in the gravel and mud driveway, one pickup truck from the looks of the wheel tracks. "Not funny, Derek," yelled Dale into the fog. "Not one bit fucking funny. You assholes are going to jail this time." Tracking mud, Dale went into the farmhouse and looked around. "I've been here, what, 3 weeks? And how many dozen times have I had to search this fucking house?" He searched it again. No muddy boot prints except his own. No sign of anything missing or disturbed. Except the fucking laptop. The ThinkPad was on again, the screen black, except for three lines of white letters burning after the C prompt. This time Dale was sure that he had shut the computer off before leaving. Disgusted, he walked over to flick the power off, not wanting to read another irritatingly cryptic message. But the stanza form of the message made him read, and the content made him pause. This was no High Middle German or Old English. Dale Stewart, Ph.D., even recognized the source. It was from Sir Walter Scott's The Lay of the Last Minstrel, Canto 6, if he remembered correctly. Claire could tell him. She had been auditing the graduate-level 18th-century literature seminar the last time he'd taught this poem. Claire remembered everything. But Claire was not around to remind him, and odds were overwhelming that she never would be again. "For he was speechless, ghastly, wan,
like him of whom the story ran, who spoke the spectre hound in man. Still disgusted, knowing that he would have to walk a couple of miles in the fog just to get his cell phone to work in order to call the Oak Hill garage to get his truck fixed, furious that he would have to deal with C.J. Congdon again, knowing in his heart that these punks were never going to be caught or punished, feeling that the mystery of the blood in the chicken coop had been solved and the all-too-mundane fact of the tire slashings, tired of this hacker bullshit, Dale pushed the off button and watched the computer screen wink to a point of light and then die to black.